From the Atlantic to the Pacific, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from the canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. I'm your host, Vance Pollock, and this is Joshua P. Warren speaking of strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests. We are the favorite program of hodags, wendigos, skunk apes, and donkey devils, not to mention benevolent space brothers. So keep it tuned right here. I'm in the studio with investigator Shelley Wright, who would like listeners to know that she has no tramp stamp. Confirmation from Shelley. No tramp stamp.
We still haven't seen it, but she says none.
There's no tramp stamp. You really want listeners to know that
I do not have a tramp stamp.
That I planted the idea that you have a Coinstar
fake news.
Tramp stamp.
Fake news.
I mean, it doesn't even have to be true if it's even suggested. Even if I just came out and said, Shelley doesn't have a Coinstar tramp stamp. Now people are going to wonder, does Shelley have a Coinstar tramp stamp?
Why would she? It should be obvious that that's just, we're just joshing.
But
some people,
during the break, Shelley, you took it a bit personally, and I apologize.
No, that's
but
okay.
You want listeners to know that you do not have a tramp stamp, because that would tarnish your
no.
spotless image.
I don't know about that.
You sit through Dark 30 every week. Come on.
I just, you know.
Okay, no tramp stamp. Shelley,
right.
Shelley wants you to know that,
duly
listener.
Noted.
She doesn't. Doesn't have a tramp stamp, Coinstar or otherwise. here's a story that I think is worth sharing. I didn't really go through here and edit, and it's a.
Oh gosh.
Anyway, we'll see. This is going to be like in that scene from Monty Python's Holy Grail, where they're reading from the scriptures about the holy hand grenade of Antioch, and they did. Feast on sloths and fruit bats and orangutans, and the other priest holds his hand up and says, skip a few, brother. if I'm getting a little too far afield as I read through this story, Sam or Shelley, just...
He can't self-edit.
Skip a few, brother. Some spooky things are happening at serial killer Ted Bundy's childhood home. In Tacoma, Washington. Unexplainable things happened in the Tacoma house where serial killer Ted Bundy grew up. So many things, in fact, that a contractor hired to remodel the home penciled Bible scriptures on the walls and brought in two pastors to bless the house. Quote, I'm not one to believe a lot of this stuff, but this house made me a believer, said the contractor. A cry for help appeared on a window as crew members worked in the basement. Heavy furniture wedged into a wall toppled over. Doors and cabinets seemed to open themselves. The real estate broker shows the fully remodeled Tacoma home he just sold, desiccated birds and all. It was the childhood home of serial murderer Ted Bundy. That's a photo caption from this article. It all started in September.
That's the self-editing there.
Yeah, it all started in September when... David Truong bought the 1,400-square-foot home with plans to redo and flip it. He didn't research its history, so he didn't know the local lore or who had lived there. The Little Blue House was built in 1946, the same year Bundy was born in Vermont. The Bundy family moved into the home in 1955, records show. Louise Bundy was no longer living there in 1989 when her 42-year-old son was executed in Florida after being convicted of killing two sorority sisters and a 12-year-old girl. Investigators linked him to at least 30 slayings, though they believe there were dozens more. His killing spree started in 1974 in Washington and continued for years across 11 states. They were a really nice family. Bundy was... 9 when his family moved into the 4-bedroom, 1.5-bathroom house. Neighbors recall him having a bedroom on the ground floor, though at least one record indicates his room was at the foot of the stairs in the basement. He lived there with his mother, stepfather, and 4 siblings. I don't even remember seeing Ted, said Hope Murray, a neighbor who grew up a few houses down and later bought her childhood home. She recalls playing with Bundy's younger sisters and Louise Bundy babysitting her. Once she went to their house but was told to stay out of Ted's room because he had the measles. They were a really nice family, she said. Bundy insisted he grew up in a wonderful home with two dedicated and loving parents. Louise Bundy was a staunch defender of her eldest son and long insisted he was innocent. Her stance softened after he made several death row confessions. In his final interview with a psychologist just before he was executed, Bundy said his family regularly attended church and believed his violence stemmed from an obsession with pornography that fueled dark fantasies. Some believe Bundy started killing when he was 14 and that Anne Marie Burr, an 8-year-old girl abducted from her North End home in August 1961, was his first victim. Bundy denied it in a letter to the girl's mother written after he was imprisoned in Florida and named as a suspect in Anne Marie's disappearance. Louise Bundy said back then she was sure he didn't commit any crimes while living under her roof, and DNA testing done in 2011 was unable to link Bundy to the missing girl. He is, however, still listed as a suspect in the case because detectives could not clear him. Despite Bundy being one of the most notorious serial killers, there is no evidence he committed any crimes in his childhood home. That doesn't stop some neighbors, and now the contractors, from believing there's something spooky about the house. Help me and leave, quotes found on the windows. Clopton, the contractor, first visited the house after he was hired in October. He took along his 11-year-old daughter, who sometimes goes with him and takes dictated notes from her dad about the work that needs to be done. My daughter started crying, he said. She said she felt weird. She didn't like it there. She refused to be alone in the house and was so uncomfortable they quickly left. Clopton returned the next week with a demolition crew. One crew member echoed the sentiment that the house didn't feel right. Then things started happening. Things Clopton kept dismissing as pranks among the crew. There was the time they re-entered the house, which had been locked, and every door, every cabinet drawer, was open. Or the time the workers were cleaning up the flooded basement and spotted the words, "Help me," written on the glass. A screwed-on screen protector would have made it difficult for someone outside to write it, Clopton said. A heavy dresser inset in the upstairs hallway somehow pulled itself out and landed face down on the floor while the crew was downstairs. Workers said it takes at least one strong man to pull it out, and there was no way it could have fallen on its own. Periodically throughout the course of the job, we had weird things keep happening, Clopton said. Cell phones and other electronics occasionally would get unplugged and immediately die. The word "leave" was found written in sheetrock dust on a bedroom floor with no footprints around it. Clopton eventually chatted with some of the neighbors about the odd occurrences, asking if there had been a rash of neighborhood break-ins. That's when he learned Bundy once lived in the house. Clopton passed the information along to Truong and the real estate broker. The broker said he was shocked but excited by the discovery because he was interested in true crime. It was really eerie but really neat, he said. We made sure to keep quiet initially because we weren't sure how people would react to knowing a serial killer lived there. Although a handful of potential buyers asked Pitts and Bundy, once calling the house home, he said the people who recently bought the house did not. It's unclear whether the new owners are aware. They were unable to be reached for comment. Two pastors and blessings. That's a headline for the... I should have looked over this a little bit. We're closing in here. After Clopton found out the house's connection to a serial killer, he decided it was time to seek help, so he called a local pastor and asked him to bless the house. Two pastors came out and went from room to room reading scriptures and saying blessings. They encouraged the crew to continue playing Christian music while they worked. They also suggested writing Bible verses on the walls, which the workers did. The penciled writings can no longer be seen beneath the fresh paint, but Clopton hopes they will continue to offer protection. Everything in that house fought us, and I was kind of weird about it, he said, but I go to church and I have God with me. The house was completely redone with new paint, a bright yellow front door, and renovated floors and ceilings, but the history remains. Ted Bundy's childhood home, Shelley, would you stay there?
don't really see any reason to stay there.
If you were in a situation where that was the only place available, or if it was an affordable house in a neighborhood you wanted to move into, would the fact that it was Ted Bundy's childhood home scare you away? Would it make you think twice?
I don't think so.
You wouldn't be too concerned with that?
Now, you remember the serial killer? He and his wife had Fox Hollow Farm. I think he was a doctor. I'm trying to remember what his name was. Sam, help me out here.
Fox Hollow Farm?
Fox Hollow Farm.
Was it local or?
No. Anyway, that place, the new owners, they knew that he was a serial killer, that he had brought people back to the farm, killed them there. They were okay with it. They didn't think anything about it. But then really strange things started happening there. Aside from the fact that you would just walk out in the woods and find random human bones.
Herb Baumeister.
That's him.
An American alleged serial killer from Westfield near Indianapolis, Indiana, committed suicide before he could be brought to trial and never confessed to the crimes he was alleged to have committed. Baumeister. Familiar with that guy,
no,
Sam?
I'm not.
Interesting. Fox Hollow Farm. Yeah. There are some places that bear a very dark, ominous vibe when you know the history, certainly.
He didn't kill anybody there.
Yeah, he did.
No, Ted Bundy.
Oh, no.
I think the example I might use that we talked about a few weeks ago is that I was in Money, Mississippi, standing on the bridge along the Tallahatchie River, and the place just felt dark and haunted. Even though I went there with the idea that it was the inspiration for the Bobby Gentry song Ode to Billy Joe, I didn't realize at the time that Emmett Till, a young African-American man, was abducted or kidnapped and murdered and thrown in the river near Money, Mississippi. So maybe we sometimes sense the darkness of a place without knowing why. And the Ted Bundy home, or the childhood home of Ted Bundy, in some sense, seemed to betray its dark past, even though they initially didn't know its history. You're listening to Speaking of Strange. We'll be right back. Another grand hour of Speaking of Strange underway. Thanks for listening to WWNC 570. We're here in the studio, Vance Pollock, myself, Shelley Wright, and Sam the sometimes animals steal. We got a special report about a special report from Josh. This is like a pre-special report from Josh, but had a chance to correspond with Josh, and he sent over a little clip he's going to let us play in his own voice, his master's voice. Joshua has recorded a new Speaking of Strange report. That's kind of like a supplemental podcast style recording that Josh just does when he can, anytime he can, on his own schedule, and then makes it available to you through speakingofstrange.com. He's going to release that tomorrow. That's Sunday on speakingofstrange.com on the podcast page. I mentioned earlier that you can go listen to back episodes, download them, collect them all, share with your friends. Speakingofstrange.com, the podcast page. Tomorrow, Josh is going to put that Speaking of Strange report, a new special report, in the voice of the man himself. And he asked me to play this clip as a plug for his friends Kevin and Steve, who have opened a new board game cafe downtown here in Asheville called Well Played. So let's hear from Josh.
I want to mention this just as a shout-out if you happen to be in the Asheville, North Carolina area. A couple of my great friends there, and I guess I'll just throw their name. It's been in the media. Kevin Fraser and Steve Green. They are a couple of the owners of this new business in Asheville, North Carolina, called Well Played Board Game Cafe. Yeah. You ever heard of that? A board game cafe. This is an establishment in downtown Asheville that has, it's brand new, okay? And they have over 500 board games. And space to play all these board games. People there to help you understand the rules of the board games. And, hey, it's Asheville. You gotta have beer. They've got craft beer there in addition to more mainstream beer, but they've got local craft Asheville beer and all that. Wine. They've got coffee. After all, it is a cafe, so they have all the stuff that a coffee and a bar have. They have food, including some stuff that it brings you back. It's nostalgic stuff that takes you back, the comfort foods from your childhood. Like, for example, you can get a pizza Hot Pocket, or you can get a grilled cheese sandwich. You know, but they also have things that are more elaborate. I mean, I'm going to be hanging out there all the time when I get back. So I'm looking forward to that. Check out their website if you're in the Asheville area. The website is wellplayedasheville.com. WELLPLAYED Asheville.com. Wellplayedasheville.com. They have the largest board game selection of any establishment that has ever been opened in the state of North Carolina. And maybe I'm getting old, but I'm a board game geek. Okay, so I hope that you will check that out.
There we go.
Josh, thank you, buddy, for checking in. And tomorrow, a special Speaking of Strange report in the voice of the man himself, JPW, will be available at the podcast page on speakingofstrange.com, as well as the replay of this show, by Monday morning or so.
What do you think about that? You know, Asheville, home to a lot of eccentric businesses, such as Shelley's, and, you know, like a lot of things you're not going to find in other cities. What do you think about a board game cafe?
I think let them give it a shot.
I mean, we got other things, you know, like the pinball place. You know, that's pretty awesome.
Oh, you know I'm the pinball queen, right?
Yeah.
I didn't know you were the queen.
Oh, my gosh.
You think you can take me on?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
It's on.
I think we should all go down there one day, and we should have a tourney.
She's got a tramp stamp of two pinball flippers.
Oh. She's got the back glass art to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the pinball game.
Shelley doesn't have a tramp stamp. For the last time, why do you people keep insisting that Shelley has a tramp
stamp.
What was your
favorite board game growing up?
You know, I liked Monopoly, and my mom did not like it because it could go on for hours. She called it monotony. That's pretty clever for my mom to come up with that.
Shelley, what was your...
It was Monopoly. I liked that one.
I was a Trivial Pursuit guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like to show off this brain.
I have a story about Trivial Pursuit.
I bet you do.
Mm.
Does it have to do with pie?
No. I had this boyfriend one time.
Trivial Pursuit.
Who loved Trivial Pursuit, and he always went on, he went on for years about, oh, I never ever lost a game of Trivial Pursuit, and he was just always nagging me to play Trivial Pursuit with him. So finally, one day, I'm like, fine, I'll play Trivial Pursuit. So I played him, and I won. And from no, you didn't really win. Let's play again. I'm like, nah, I won.
I'm
fair
sorry,
and square.
It's the moops.
But the questions they were too easy. Hey, I still won. I'm not playing a rematch with you. Oh, and it drove him insane, which was great.
Matt Matan is a Trivial Pursuit master, and he used to do here on the station, if he'd get snowed in or whatever, he would just go on the air and read out Trivial Pursuit questions and write down his answers, or he would, you know, keep his answers in his head. He would read out the questions to listeners, and then he would say, let's see how you did against me, and he would give his answers and check the answers, and Matt Matan would stump, or would, you know, thoroughly thrash listeners of WWNC at Trivial Pursuit back in the day. And he did a Facebook Live Trivial Pursuit competition a month or so back. And I got on there and I took him on, and I couldn't hang with him. In like one round, I think I was tied with him, but I did not beat Matt Matan. Facebook Live, Trivial Pursuit, but he's out there.
I've tried out for Jeopardy 3 times. Once, actually, you know, like at the bus, you know, like when they had the bus city to city thing, and you had to wait in line for like 8 hours.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It was hard. It was really hard, because, like, you can sit at your house all you want, and just in at the Steele residence, me and Dad go at it pretty hard.
Right.
Mom's more the wheel. And okay. Me and Dr. Steele are the Jeopardy guys, and we like... He always says it's unfair because I can read faster than him. And, you know, if you were actually on the show, it's all about – I had a friend or I played tennis with a guy whose wife was on. And he's like, if you've made it to the show, everybody knows the answers to every question. It's all about your timing, you know, like on the buzzer. If you buzz in too quick, it blocks you out for like 3 seconds.
Okay.
So it all has to do with the timing of the buzzer. And once you can get into the – like the best guy – one of the best guys ever was the blind guy. And, you know, he would get into this zen state of knowing exact, and Ken Jennings, too, was like buzzer, knowing when to hit that button. But, yeah, I'm always been a but if you do the tryout, they give you a printed out sheet of 10 questions. And you have to get all 10 right just to move to the next round. And they are hard. It's not like you can think you're a boss at your house by yelling out, who is, you know, Arthur Clark or whatever. Like, but no. These are hard, and they don't tell you which ones you got wrong or right. They're just like, sorry, next. And I got a pen. That was nice.
Here's what I think of a board game cafe. It would be fun to, you know, like down at Pritchard Park or whatever, the chess players will sit there on one side of the chessboard and just wait for somebody to come up to challenge them. In the board game cafe, you could go in there and like get your game of choice out and set it up and just wait for someone to come up and challenge you at Parcheesi.
Or Pollyanna. What's the Battleship?
Battleship. That would probably be a fun one.
I liked Battleship.
So, yeah, Rock'em Sock'em Robots. You're just sitting there
is that a board game?
Would it qualify?
Hungry Hippos, is that a board game?
Well, I guess we'll just have to go down to the board game cafe and Well Played and find out. Gnip Gnop.
I don't know what the heck you're talking about.
You don't know what I'm talking
about.
Gnip Gnop. Look it up. Children of the 70s
All right,
may remember.
Lewis Carroll.
We'll be right back. Speaking of strange. Yeah, some of you were feeling that way a couple days ago. Somebody's best friend died. Chris Cornell, Godspeed, buddy. Frontman for Soundgarden, Audioslave, had a couple really good solo albums.
Mother Love Bone?
Temple of the Dog.
Temple of the Dog, sorry.
Yeah, he was good friends with Andy from Mother Love Bone, and somebody was telling me the other day that Mother Love Bone was the band that was poised to be what Nirvana became, but the lead singer overdosed before they could be pushed.
Like Green River was the band that Pearl Jam was to be? If we're going deep into Seattle.
Okay, Green River.
Green River. So, early Pearl Jam members?
I don't know that, man.
I just stump you.
There's a lot of music out there. Skin Yard, Screaming Trees, Mudhoney. Anyway. Enough music trivia. There's going to be dozens and dozens of listeners.
Was he, were they Seattle or North Pacific Northwest Soundgarden?
Yes, they were Seattle. As a matter of fact, Soundgarden is a sculpture park, or it is kind of like a interactive sculpture, wind chimes and metal arrangements. It seems like I should be artsy enough to installment. That's the word I was looking for. It's like a sculptural installment in Seattle, Soundgarden. That's where they got
it. I never knew that.
Yeah. Soundgarden. It's one word.
I knew that.
Okay. Chris Cornell. Yeah, he left us some great music. So that one, Mind Riot off Bad Motor Finger. Oh, too much music trivia. I want to kind of elaborate a little bit. I suggested, at least indirectly last week, about my Believer experience observing the doorknob turn in the house, an unused door, for that matter, that was last used by my grandmother when she was staying in the bedroom on the other side and she needed immediate access or quicker access to the living room, being a frail elderly old woman. I didn't come right out and say that I believed it was the spirit of my grandmother turning the doorknob, but you may have drawn that conclusion, and that's right. I do believe that it was my grandmother, because in life, my grandmother was a psychic sensitive. From my father and aunt's earliest memories, my father wouldn't talk about this stuff. Because it was, to my grandmother, it was not something that she was proud of. It was kind of a burden to her to have this gift. But when anyone in the immediate family were going to die, the spirit of her brother Walter, who had died during the Spanish influenza epidemic in 1918.
Nobody expects the Spanish influenza.
Nobody expects the Spanish influenza. But it was epidemic, and it killed more people than casualties of World War I. Actually, circulating the disease by moving troops around the world led to more deaths through the influenza than were actually killed by bullets during World War I. Civilians as well as soldiers. So my grandmother's brother, Walter, and his wife and two of their children died within days. And I've seen the receipts from the undertaker to put them on the train and ship them up to Orlando to the funeral home. And it was kind of like a buy one, get one deal. At the bottom of the receipt, he's got like a running account for the family. Walter Tanner, Rose Tanner, infant Tanner. And then at the bottom, by the time he writes in the second child, he just writes in the numbered column off to the side, no charge. It's like you've paid for two parents and one of their children to be shipped to Orlando for burial by train. The fourth, you know, the second child is on the house. You know, it's like a bonus. It was kind of creepy to look at it that way, but you can imagine even the undertaker who had handled dead bodies for a living, sees the tragedy in this case. The mother and father perish, the child, another child, and he's like, give these poor people a break. If someone in the family were to die, Walter would let my grandmother know so that, I mean, again and again, my aunt is the one that first told me about it when I was a teenager. They would get the phone call and say, let Julia, my grandmother, let Julia know that cousin so-and-so has passed away or that aunt so-and-so passed away. And my aunt would go to her and say, Mom, cousin Elizabeth died. And Grandma would just nod her head and say, I know that Walter came and told me. And she always kind of thought, well, is Mom just, is there a screw loose or something? Is Mom, but Uncle Walter was always there when she was sick or close to death or whatever. She always saw Uncle Walter, or if other people in the family were dying, Uncle Walter would communicate with her. So one day my aunt goes to visit and my grandmother is very worried, and she's like, oh, I'm so glad you're here. Have you seen your sister, Estelle? Yeah, I just saw Estelle. Just came from her house, as a matter of fact. She's fine. What about your sister, Ellen? Have you seen your sister, Ellen? And she's like, yeah, well, I think me and Estelle were talking about her. I think she was on the phone with her yesterday. Everything's fine. Mom, what's got you worried? She could tell she was anxious. Mom, what's worrying you? And she said, Walter came to visit. And he said, Julia, I'm so sorry. I have to take one of the girls.
Oh, I got goosebumps.
And my aunt was like, oh, Mom, don't worry yourself over that. Just pray about it. You know, don't worry about it. Don't worry about what Walter says, but Walter's never been wrong, and Walter always lets me know, and why would Walter lie to me? She said, Mom, you just got to relax, you know, take a nap or something. And she was not a very old woman at that time, and she was very clear-headed. She was not suffering from dementia or anything like that. So this anxiety over Walter saying, I've got to take one of the girls, had her so worried that later that afternoon, when they got a phone call from one of the cousins saying, Esther, let Aunt Julia know that Monette died. She was like, oh, I figured it out. She went to her and said, Mom, Monette died. When Uncle Walter and Aunt Rose and the two children died, they left two orphans, Monette and Vivian.
Oh.
And so when my Aunt Esther went to my grandmother and said, we got the phone call, Monette died. Your niece, Monette, died. She said, oh, how selfish of me. When Walter said he had to take one of the girls, I thought he was talking about one of my girls, but he was coming for one of his girls.
Oh.
If that doesn't show precognition, I don't know what kind of example I could give that would prove precognitive communication with the spirit to inform you of coming death or impending death
omen. Isn't that what it's called?
Yeah, it's specifically her brother. So they're very dark stuff, and from time to time, I might tell you other personal anecdotes from the family tree, because it's a haunted one on almost every side. And like I say, these are not stories that I heard my father tell.
A lot they were, of nooses on that family tree.
Yeah, those too. I can tell you about my great-grandfather, who was a Georgia sheriff during Reconstruction. Ugly, ugly. Murderous things going on in those days down in central Georgia. But There's his gunshots as we speak. But my father would only confirm with a nod or kind of try to steer the conversation in a different direction when confronted with some of these stories. Dad, is this true about Grandma? Well, that's what she always said. But let's talk about the fishing report from the paper today. You are listening to Joshua P. Warren's Speaking of Strange, and we'll be right back. This is Speaking of Strange calling across the airwaves through your radio set. I'm your host, Vance Pollock, joined in the studio by paranormal investigator Shelley Wright and Sam the Animal Steel producing. Except no substitutes. This is the real deal, Speaking
the,
of Strange.
The real deal, Sam Steel. You can use that in lieu of the animal if you were so inclined.
Sam, the real deal.
The real deal, Sam Steele.
The real deal, Sam Steele. Yeah. Okay. I may use that. Did you know? I'm going to throw a little Norse trivia at you. I do that. I'm a Norse whisperer.
Not going to get that in Trivial Pursuit. Not getting the pie piece on Norse trivia.
Yeah. My friends used to call me the Norse whisperer because I knew all about the Norse gods.
That's better than Vance Monument.
You like Norse whisperer? Vance Norse whisperer, Pollock? It just doesn't ring. But it's not quite as
Asheville-centric. I'm picturing you in a unitard, wrestling, what do they call those things? Singlet. The Norse whisperer.
In olden days, in Iceland, where much of the Nordic lore was preserved in the literature of that country, it was a charge that could be prosecuted for a man to write a love poem to a woman, to a married woman, or to an unwilling woman who he was trying to seduce, because they believed that the power of poetry in that language and to a skilled poet was akin to magic, that the poetry, the words, could persuade women to do things they did not want to do and woo them away from their husband true. Did that rhyme? Wow. I'm doing some poetry here. I'm not doing this poetry to seduce anyone. No arrest warrants coming down from Iceland, where I formerly resided, in case you didn't know that. My wife's a native of that strange island where they still build the roads around fairy mounds so as not to offend the nature spirits. Yeah. That's that's true. Even the most sober and serious politicians and banker types and no-nonsense materialists in Iceland still have a respect for the nature spirits. Whether they believe in them or not, they understand that the folk do, the people do, and they're not going to offend those traditions or sensibilities. So the whole thing that got me on this line of thought about the magic of poetry, it's my pitch to some people out there who may not be musical sorts. The music that I have very carefully curated to use as bumpers in this show, in many cases, maybe not so much during Dark 30, but during the rest of the show, it, to me at least, conjures something, captures something, encapsulates something of the other, the numinous, the spiritual. And Shelley and I were talking about the surf guitar bumpers that we're using at the ends of segments these days. And most people say that that surf vibe really resonates with them. It's reverbed out. It's got a lot of sort of dark tones and everything like that. It lends itself well to supernatural themes. So, some of you folks out there who just don't get it might want to listen more closely to the lyrics. Sometimes a few words can evoke a response that, to me, is very spiritual. Sacred music. And not that we're playing gospel hymns and things
although
here,
we
but
were
the tradition
off
of...
the air the other week.
We certainly were. The tradition of gospel music, sacred music, embraces the idea of the power of the poetry and the tone and the music and everything to create an atmosphere, to generate a environment that's conducive to that sort of worship. In our case, our shrine is right here in the 570 studios where we proselyte to people who are curious about the paranormal. And I think that long after these long-winded tales that I sometimes weave here on the story are lost to memory, there will be little nuggets preserved in the lyrics of songs. That's why I think it was really important to me, and I was so proud the other week to debut the Scatterling song about Sheriff John Lyerly.
Having Stevie in the studio, too, and singing that Stevie song live was pretty cool, too.
Yeah, so we experiment with some things that are rather new to the format. They may not have happened when Joshua P. Warren was at the helm, but we're experimenting with music, and there's magic in music. So keep that in mind.
It's the universal language.
And I think the three of us share a chemistry and appreciation for the arts of music and poetry. And this is Speaking of Strange, nonetheless, evolving and keeping it true. We'll be right back with the Dark 30 Hour.